thank you all for coming. today I'm gonna talk about Ashoka the Great, who was emperor of the Mauryan Empire, people call it, Mauryan period as well. It's where Indian history properly starts from. And I'm going to talk about it in relation to archaeological concepts of power. And I kind of, squeeze like too much content, in my abstract. So I just show some of the data on my slides, but I just go through quickly some of them.
It's a bit slow. If you press, then there's a delay, I think.
Well, are you using an arrow key?
Yeah.
Can you help him?
Space or enter? It's good. Maybe it's not that.
Because it worked just a moment ago.
Oh yeah.
Use this arrow. Use this one here, Simon.
Yeah. Thank you. Different ways of perceiving power in archaeology, and I always classify this kind of scholars in like power or last time personhood or whatever in into internalists or externalists or maybe somewhere in between. And then but the most common view on power in archaeology is like to see the power as like personal potency. It's more like in man's definition it's very clear, but the ability to pursue and attain goals through mastery of one's environment. But on the other side, what I call externalists, they see power as a kind of a machinery, and they think that it doesn't matter who operates, state apparatus, whoever in charge of power can, have a can cause a same effects. And more kind of recently, like structurationists, they're thinking that power is more like power relations. Like even Foucault, who earlier insisted kind of external type of power, later, thoughts that power doesn't exist, but they're just power relations. And it's all about duality and in social science and structuration, in 80s and all. And then so I archaeologists also got influences from sociologists.
Which key was it?
I think I pressed and then I use text called Arthashastra a lot when I talk about power. It's like manual on statecraft, written from the perspective of the ruling class, I consider it as something like some form of a depersonalized power. And it kind of Indian philosophy also has some parallel with archaeological theories. Knowledge of shastras as Ali pointed out, has to be accompanied by real experience. Knowledge has to meet the capability of a man ruler. It's this kind of concept continues as a Kotori culture and well up to 10th century. But you know, Shastra itself is you know, often considered as an early historic text. And yeah, so Pavlova, you know, I kind of wrote these kind of issues, and then raised these issues, and the empire also, you know, how it functions in the different models. And yeah, Mauryan Empire, you know, it was originally you know, based in Magadha or, you know, surrounding areas, and it was established by Chandragupta Maurya around 317 BC. You know, he conquered the pre-existing Nanda dynasty, and it was, you know, very strategic point. And then, so there are three rulers of three significant rulers of the Mauryan Empire, and you know, we are sure, you know, it was established by Chandragupta. You know, the you know, Greek sources, you know, talking about him. And and then of course we have you know, substantial, you know, epigraphic evidence for Ashoka. And after Ashoka, we don't really know, like, we have different genealogies, but you know, from Purana or, you know, somewhere else, but they are not agreeing with each other. And then generally thought as first South Asian empire, so pan-Indian state or even super state, whatever definition goes. And to understand empire, you know, we archaeologists you know, use a man's source of social power, you know, military, political, economic, and ideological. And that I'm kind of working, you know, today more on ideological power. But Maori Empire, of course, you know, empire was acquired and expanded through brute fact of military might. You know, it was the military expansionist, and, you know, political Mauryan control, perhaps through ideology as well, you know, provincial administration quite important, and, you know, economic and, you know, political economy, subsistence economy, you know, was responsibility of the empire. And the ideology, I'm gonna talk more about it. And, you know, archaeological records, we can see, you know, ideology in materialized form. And then the argument of, you know, few anthropologists in UCLA, materialization is transformation of ideas, values, stories, myths, and the like, into physical reality. And, you know, you can see in, you know, ceremonial event or even in writing system. And then in the bottom, you know, kind of shows, so, you know, cultural assemblage of Maori Empire, a bit of settlement hierarchy diagram there, but you know, it manifests power as well. And and the Ashokan edicts, you know, I'm going to talk a bit more about it, but my supervisor kind of pointed out that you know, it's more about Ashokan edicts, you know, materialization of power. And and, you know, he thought it as an imperial strategy for proselytizing Buddhism. And but he is a you know, prehistoric archaeologist, and you know, I don't think he would go into it further. Yeah, this is just Ashoka the Great, who wrote the royal orders, Ashokan edicts, and you know, was a transmitted from the imperial capital of Magadha to Greater Magadha, or, you know, borderlands of empire. And was, you know, written on rocks, caves, and pillars, and quite monumental. And, you know, the list of different types, you know, was about moral precepts, social welfare, like, you know, or, you know, dissemination of religious ideology, and so forth. And, you know, also written in Greek, Aramaic, and, you know, and then there are different versions, slight difference in, you know, grammar and all, and what's meant for the whole empire. And Yeah, and then when we talk about Ashoka in terms of kingship, we have problem of Hindu versus Buddhist models of kingship, which Julia Shaw kind of pointed out, and then the harmonical model of kingship is based on, largely based on Arta Shastra, but archaeologists are just unquestionably take Arta Shastra as early historic text, but it's now agreed that it was compiled by, you know, just before the Gupta period. But my research on textual parallel between early historic fortification and Arta Shastra, you know, show that, you know, fortifications, you know, schematic fortification described in Arta Shastra much earlier, and then Arta Shastra kind of documenting norms rather, which are much older than the text itself. So you know, I think it's still valid to talk about Brahmanical model of kingship, and then whether the text was anachronistic or not, we don't really know. And then people also, you know, talked about non-specific Buddhist orientation of the text. You know, a lot of issues, you know, but at the same time, Buddhist qualities of the edicts, was no doubt Buddhist in nature, but you know, the empire is so diverse, and so it was wasn't explicit, but rather suggestive, and then here, you know, there occurs, you know, another kind of problem that, you know, is a model of proselytization of Buddhism and versus religious tolerance, there's a reciprocity between Buddhism and Brahmanism, but you know, we never know if they got support from the state much, but you know, of course, to some extent. And Ashoka also, patronized Avijikas and other religions, and was a kind of control of diversity. But I just want to talk about secularization of technical terms and its implication. There's many problems with Ashoka edicts, and then one of them is like Ashoka's original vocabularies, and he was, you know, playfully replacing certain terms, you know, Gombrich noticed as well, I recently got more kind of substantial evidence. I was assisting Professor Wright's work. He's a kind of expert in Prakrit and, you know, pretty much everything else, but he learned new language every year, and then this is a Rock Edict 8, and then there's a Nikkamitta Sambodhi, you know, went forth to Sambodhi, and then people thought it was Buddhist, or he became enlightened, or, you know, went to a place called Sambodhi, that's Buddha Bodhgaya, but it's been really kind of debated over the last century or something, and then finally, you know, Professor Wright suggested that there was kind of secularization of term, and then in Prakrit Nigam, Nirgam, all these verbs get mixed up and stuff, and then he also, you know, reached same conclusion as Gombrich, and then, you know, he kind of went back to non-technical sense of Sambodhi, and, you know, so it was a kind of a secularization, and then, you know, I just think that, you know, it's something to do with, for example, Mann's model of Ashoka's universal pacification, you know, couldn't be too Buddhist to explicitly, you know, Buddhism was a minority religion rather at that time, and then I also, you know, I come back to this point later, but think about new cons- I mean, new to South Asia, but I'm borrowing concept from South American archaeology, but there was a kind of rather compartmentalization to some extent, you know, the state kind of compartmentalized provinces, you know, to prevent them to form alliance and to preserve a local structure intact for, you know, more efficient governance. And then we see this is kind of a you know, structure of Mauryan Empire and but that, you know, I want to talk a bit about territoriality. You know, of course, Ashokan Edict itself has classified into different groups, but this kind of group, you know, kind of suggested according to settlement hierarchy, you know, size of the settlements, and then you know, Alchin's fourth group here, you know, in south there is a kind of concentration of edicts and with a different nature, and then my supervisor pointed out that it corresponds to later Satavahana heartland, and it's very interesting. And Sugandhi's work also suggested that, you know, indirect Mauryan control on southern Deccan, and then you know, we cannot judge from the geographical extent, but was rather loosely structured empire he suggested, and then we don't get the you know, other kinds of royal artifacts from Mauryan Empire, which we get in Gangatic Valley. So, you know, homogeneity wasn't really the case all the time. And Monica Smith from UCLA, like she's rather thinking, you know, Mauryan Empire as knots of networks, like, you know, with different kinds of links, you know, rather than, you know, vast geography, you know, they kind of conquered, and then rather, you know, networks in terms of, for example, in South, she emphasized kind of each-to-each links, like in terms of, you know, the nature of edicts, or you know, like nature of so settlement sizes, or you know, all those excavated materials, and then so you know, she also suggested different model of empire, and then this is just a plain map of you know, Mauryan Empire, but I forgot that. And then, you know, you get the here concentration of you know, kind of edicts, like quite a lot in southern Deccan, and then here you get the Kalinga, ancient Kalinga, you know, Ashoka kind of merged here, and then recent evidence shows that, you know, abrupt in kind of abrupt change in, you know, cultural assemblage there after the time of Ashoka's conquest, and then, you know, it has a kind of a, you know, like own you know, unit here with different potteries and all, and then here the Gilnar Sopara, and then you get the Karoshti inscription, and then there's a Guhabihara inscription from Matra, a little bit later, but also in Karoshti, but quite early. And then here, you know, one big kind of chunk of a linguistic kind of group, and then Gangatic Valley also, you know, it's a kind of unit. So we see the territoriality in this way, and then you know, people, you know, talked about you know, purpose of you know, rock edicts, and traditionally for, you know, thought as imperial boundaries, and then, you know, it's just a debate continues. But what I'm suggesting now is, I think that major rock edicts, you know, elected on borderlands of Mauryan Empire was actually Ashoka's circumambulation of the empire's Indo-European king. You know, Samudragupta Vijaya, you know, Ingold said that Chakravartin of Iltana made a circuit of conquests like Sun's movement, and this idea goes back to Indo-European antiquity, and high kings of Pelian Island were, you know, doing the same. Right, of course, India is much bigger, and then Chakrabartin, I'm not going to talk much about it, about him, but you know, several Buddhist texts have a list, but took him as a universal sovereign, and, you know, quite military in nature, with magical weapons, and everything, and then you see the chakra there also, and then you know, I'm just reconsidering you know, traditional model of Ashokan edicts as, you know, boundary back markers, you know, in a new Indo-European context. You know, Raja, for example, meaning king, you know, originally meant king originally has to, you know, determine the boundaries of a temple or town or kingdom, and you know, Raja Ashoka called himself, you know, goes back to Vedic Rajan, and the king, you know, old time king is practically confined to the extremities of the Indo-European world, and then you know, king and connection between king and bab, meaning make straight, direct. You know, he thinks it's a strong clue to the original nature of kingship, you know. And then, I'm just doing a bit of comparative studies, and also, another nature of Indo-European kingship is that kings shouldn't control the outer regions of the kingdoms directly, and then, Caravella is, he's the only, king who was inscribed as, you know, Chakravartin before 5th century AD, and he's quite early, and then there's not much chronological gap between him and Ashoka, and he also identified himself as a king of Kalinga, just as Ashoka, he claimed himself as a king of Magadha. And also Samudragupta, he didn't annex the whole of his subjugated regions, and then it was quite indirect. And then, of course, chakra wheel, it's a wheel of a sun, and then, you know, was worshipped as a deity by Indo-European people, and then Chakravartin, it's a bit of a divine kingship, and then, you know, all sorts of evidence I've got, and then perhaps there were other purposes, you know, as well. You know, was one of the purposes I'm proposing was boundary marker as well, but in the European context, I'm just suggesting, and then of course was part of imperial strategies and all. It's quite interesting, and then, you know, just as a boundary markers, you know, Ashoka himself styled himself as a Magadha king, and then I think for pillar edicts, he might have been marking his Magadha territory or Greater Magadha. There's a new book about Greater Magadha by, I forgot the name.
Harry Fogg?
No. Brahmanism in the shadow of Hinduism.
I can't remember, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I forgot that.
He's German, I can't really pronounce his name.
Oh, sorry. I thought you know.
I can't really pronounce his name.
Fortification, like, at the capital city, you know, you get fortification, and then I'm also thinking that, I did my dissertation, early historic fortifications in India, and then it was something to do with drawing boundaries as Indo-European king. king's responsibility. And Sishvalgalfair, another Chakrabartin called Karabera, his inscription is just there. It's you know, beautifully fortified, and then it's as you know, recent radiocarbon dates, you know, data fortification system to the 7th to 6th centuries BC, which is much earlier than Mauryan period. And I'm finishing off very soon, but now I'm doing comparative studies of early historic, between early historic fortifications and late Bronze Age and Iron Age hill forts in Celtic Ireland. And of course, it's far apart, and then, you know, but it's Indo-European, you know, connection, and then I think it's very interesting to talk about. And then Tara was considered the capital city of High Kings, but you know, literally evidence comes from much later, the medieval Ireland, but it retains all the Indo-European vocabulary and possibly, you know, culture. And then, yeah, settlement pattern, you know, like morphological features I'm interested in. And then, High Kings also, you know, often associated with secular kingship, and, you know, get this kind of ceremonial pillar was must be ceremonial center. And then, you know, and then you get circular fortifications, you know, in India as well, recently found. And as a conclusion, I kind of trying to piece together all the points I made, but you know, Ashoka was quite charismatic, and then, you know, he you know, I mean, just after him we don't get you know, any significant name of the Mauryan kings. Maybe Mauryan empire, you know, declined after him, and you know, power kind of model is quite complex, you know, a lot of power relations, networks, and then for secularization of time, you know, it can be interpreted in several different ways, including, you know, Indo-European suggestion I'm having, it's quite interrelated, and then different models of structure of the empire and territoriality, and then the concept behind, you know, can be, you know, Indo-European. And then it's no more that, like, you know, struggle for power, but more like cooperation and reciprocity. And then, yeah, just I have to do more of a contextual kind of research, region to region, like settlement, you know, and I have to find out geographical units, and then or pre-Mauryan, post-Mauryan occupations at, you know, archaeological sites, and then, you know, I do it comparatively or relatively, you know, I have to look up all these pieces of evidence I can consult with. And yeah, I think that's pretty much about 20 minutes. And thank you. Thank
you. Is this your PhD project?
No, it's just a gap year project.
Is it gap year project?
Yeah.
Oh, really? This wasn't what you proposed to be that got you in for your D-Phil?
Oh, no.
It seems to be related. Was it the power and empire? Or
empires of faith. Yes.
Oh, empires of faith. Okay. It seems that it would correlate with...
I'm gonna work on Gupta period, mostly, but, you know, at least I got evidence of Samudragupta as Chakrabarti and stuff, and then empire, and then it's gonna be all useful, I suppose. And
could I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
You talk about Margata.
Yeah.
And I understand in the Vedic texts, so this, I guess, would be several centuries before the Mauryan period, Margata is seen as somewhat ambivalently as a an alternative cultural centre that has a culture that's different. It's clearly different from the majority of Vedic culture. I was wondering whether you could say anything about the relationship between Margadan culture and Buddhism?
Terms of Buddhism, I think Magadha was where you know, all sorts of kind of new religions came about, and then, of course, it was center of power as well. Like you know, there have been, you know, large continuous settlements there as well, and then I think there was good patronage of kings to all sorts of religious activities, and
even before Ashoka.
Because in Gangatic Valley we have evidence of continuous occupation, historical evidence also, tales of all these Magadhan imperialism before Ashoka, the Nanda dynasty, or at the time of Buddha as well, like Bimbisara, like King Bimbisara, and then pottery evidence and fortification, you know, they go back, for example, site of Kausambi, which can be, you know, incorporated to larger Magadha, you get, arguably the foundation of a city to, you know, 1000 BC, circa 1000 BC. So I guess a lot of economic activities going on, like, apart from political economy as well. And then we never know how those cities, you know, came about, like, was inexplicable without authority, or more like organic development, and then but certainly, like, yeah, some movement was happening there in Magadha, I guess.
could I ask you another question? you talked about kings establishing their territory through circumambulating it, or something, going around it, and you think Ashoka did that. I was wondering, at the time, from that culture, it seems to me that they had a way of doing that, which was sacrificial, which was via the Ashvamedha sacrifice.
Yeah.
Would Ashoka, do you think, have considered, if he was a great king, would he have considered performing an Ashvamedha, and why didn't he? Why did he go for another sort of why did he go for another option?
I mean, He kind of proclaimed that, you know, he would kill at least animals in Ashokan edicts, and then he kind of he banned animal sacrifice the Meza Rock Edict 7.
Yeah.
But he says that, you know, it's not like total ban. He says it's not total ban, but he just minimizes the number of killing, and then of course Ashvamedha is really Indo-European, and then we get lot of evidence of horse sacrifice everywhere, and then chakra and, you know, sands, all, you know, associated with chariot, and of course in Vedic culture as well, and then of course in consecration ceremony and stuff, you know, was quite important. And then Ashoka himself, I think, had a horse sacrifice as well. I think presumably, judging from the content of edict, and then he kind of converted, and, you know, he was a kind of warlord before, and then I don't think he, you know, cared about non-killing anything, but he kind of converted into Buddhism after the Kalinga War, and then I don't think he did Ashwamedha after, you know, all this, after kind of erecting all the edicts and stuff. But it's kind of, quite original and atypical. And
how was he converted? How did he convert?
We just know that he kind of, he said that he went to Sangha, but you know, in Major Rock Edict 1, and then that's substantial evidence we have. And but Gombich says that it's not like going into Sangha, but more like in general, you know, in that context it was strange, like, you know, Ashoka, you know, becoming a monk, but it was more like getting to know, you know, more about Buddhism and stuff, and then later, you know, texts, you know, we get Ashoka Vardhana and stuff much later, and then they're not consistent, you know, there are few accounts on Ashoka, but they're not consistent, and then what is consistent is his name is Ashoka, or he was a king of Magadha, his capital was Pataliputra, like all these really basic things, and so yeah, but conversion, we don't know, like, but we assume that you know, he was a kind of Indic king, you know, the Brahmanic background and Brahmanical kingship, and then it's, I don't know, it's hard to say how much it was secular and.
And it's a very early form of Buddhism, right? Because this is very early form, right?
Yeah.
But he also, like, made certain changes
to Buddhism.
In the previous Buddhist practices.
Oh yeah.
It was his own religion. Some people even call it Ashoka Dhamma. Mm.
Mm. Oh, so actually Buddhism was transformed under Ashoka.
Ashoka certainly did, yeah. I forgot now the changes he made, but I'm quite sure he didn't adopt Buddhism as it was during his time. He made certain transformations and actually implemented the modified version.
Okay.
What were those changes? I would like to recall or like to find out again.
Like, historically, is he somewhat sort of implicated in or responsible for the transition or the kind of development of Mahayan Buddhism?
No, nothing to do. Mahayan is like after this. This is 278 BC or something? 260 BC?
Mid 3rd century, more or less. But he kind of institutionalized Buddhism, but at the same time, you know, that time Buddhism had only one sect, like presumably kind of a Theravada, and then he the schism edicts, you know, he kind of tried to, you know, prevent, you know, the Buddhist communities from splitting, like you know, forming different sects and stuff.
But
so,
if he, I certainly recall that when I read the history of India in my textbooks, Ashoka made some transformations. And when he made some transformations, he actually created a split.
Mm. He created a split.
Yeah. Because Mahayana Buddhism, you gave really good idea to think about. That is 1st century, and that is 2.5 centuries after Ashoka, something like that, right?
A bit more, maybe.
we
get really early Mahayana texts, we get in 1st century AD.
Less than 3 centuries.
Kashyapa
Parivartha. 3 years is quite a lot of time.
Yeah.
So I think, as far as I know, Mahayana Buddhism is Kashmir Shaivism and Tibetan Buddhism, and their common process of dialogue. I think Mahayana emerged out of those dialogues.
Yeah, but
that's when the name Theravada is Hinayana.
Well, I mean, we have to remember that when we're talking about Mahayana Buddhism in these early points, we're not talking about a separate sort of sect. We're probably originally talking about monks who had different ideas, but there was no schism because they didn't have a competing monastic rule.
Well, just that's right, because I think, yeah, because we don't really know what's the term Mahayana. I mean, when this term Mahayana, you know, emerged.
Sure.
I mean, there's no, like...
So we're using it quite anachronistically here.
It was Brahminical version. Mahayana was Brahminical version. When Brahmins made certain transformations in Buddhism, they named their transformed version as the greater vehicle. And the traditional Buddhism, which was Theravada, as a smaller vehicle, Hinayana.
But I mean, I'm just asking that simply because if Ashoka was involved in Ashwamedha sacrifices, there would be some Hinduism going into the kind of Buddhism he's following.
I think Hinduism, I don't know, but what's more like. Orthodox Brahmanism, but of course we can, you know, regard it as kind of wider sense of Hinduism, which happens like a bit late, but you know, but kind of similar process as, you know, to you know, kind of Gupta period and stuff like Guptas are reviving you know, Brahmanism and then promoting, you know, more general kind of Hinduism, and then of course he kind of you know, incorporated all those minor religions, or you know, maybe Ashoka edicts located you know, in vicinities of all the sacred places in, you know, in different localities, and then maybe incorporating local cults as well, and then it's quite Hindu in a way, that his approach.
What is taking, I mean, how far south does his kingdom extend, and what is taking place at this time, contemporaneous to him, further south?
Oh, south, southern Deccan, you know, like we got all the edicts, but you know, his power didn't go below that, and then that was really, you know, strategic point, and then you know, that locality was really powerful, and then he, you know, he didn't decide to, you know, conquer them neither, and then it's quite unstable, and I think that from there he couldn't go further, as far as you know, we know from you know, MRE, I mean, major rock edicts and stuff. It's but he went as far as he couldn't, you know, it's almost like whole subcontinent.
Yeah, it's really.
I'm afraid we've sort of got to cut a bit behind schedule, but so I think we really ought to get Bonapon to talk now before we run out of time. Thank you, Ken, again.
Thank you.
Clapping hands myself.